How often do people recommend Lolita?
Ugh.
Right? I think people potentially mistake what Nabokov is doing with Lolita, right? It's not a romance.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Lolita, the greatest romance novel of the canon, right?
Hello, and welcome to episode 52 of Shelf Love. Every week, I come up with a new way to explain what this podcast is about, because I'm still figuring it out. It's definitely about romance novels, though. I'm Andrea Martucci, host of the Shelf Love podcast, and today I am sharing conversations with two guests about one of the greatest literary debates of our time, the canon, specifically the romance canon, and even more specifically, Shelf Love's modern romance canon. I mostly explain this in the context of the conversation, but just to be totally clear, the Modern Romance Canon is a project that I started in December 2019 when I began asking my guests what they would nominate for the Modern Romance Canon. Now, to be fair, when I started asking this question, I didn't actually explain how I was defining Modern Romance Canon, so the first guests who answered it didn't have the same guardrails that later guests had. So it's now July 2020. And my current count is 11 guests nominating a total of 15 romances. I'm going to keep exploring this question, but it seemed like it was time to pause and work through some of the valid questions that I and others might have about what the heck I was or am trying to accomplish. So in this episode, you will hear first from Katrina Jackson, who shares her thoughts through the lens of a historiographer, so from a bit of an outsider viewpoint. Then I share a very recent conversation with Eric Selinger, a popular romance academic who brings a literary perspective to this question. Katrina, what is your modern romance canon nomination or nominations?
So I'm going to echo a recommendation from a previous episode and Beverly Jenkins Forbidden, which I adore and am thinking about as an academic as well. But I just sort of love the way that on the one hand, Beverly Jenkins, as I said on another episode, actually, what I love about that book is the way that she turns a sort of convention in romance, that whiteness or proximity to whiteness, as valuable on its head. For the mailman character, Ryan, whiteness is valuable, and he has used, you know, his ability to pass to better himself financially and to help his community. But it is not the most valuable thing to him. And it never requires that he sever his connection to his own Black heritage or the Black community around him, which is why at the end, when he essentially shirks all of that off, it is almost as if it means nothing to him, because the thing that is most valuable to him is love. So I love that book. The other book is Rebecca Weatherspoon's Sanctuary, which you talked about on a previous episode. I adore Rebecca, but that is actually, I think, my favorite book by her for so many reasons. But the thing that I sort of deeply connect to is that she manages to always write these male main characters who are so in need of and searching for love, even if they don't quite ever sort of say that that's or understand that that's what they're doing. And then she gives them, in her het romances or her male-female romances, she gives them a female partner who is standoffish because of their own, like in that case, their own literal like hurts and recent trauma until she's safe. And then you realize that these are two people who can give each other literally all the things they want. So like safety and protection, or as the book title suggests, sanctuary, but also love and acceptance that has been denied in other ways. And it is like watching, I love that book. And it's like watching two people who are sort of really wary of other people and really sort of hurt by life kind of circle one another right from the moment they meet, and then kind of almost offhandedly sort of give each other what they need without quite realizing that the other person needs it, but also yeah, that they're giving it. Like it is just this sort of beautiful exploration of two people learning that they can trust one another and then being able to give each other that in the end. I mean, it's beautiful. I think that is one of those moments where we see people building the tools to love one another as the book sort of progresses.
Yeah. And do you happen to know when Forbidden came out? 2016? Really?
Is it really that late?
I mean, no. Maybe that's a reissue. But
No,
maybe.
it looks like it is. No, you know, that actually does make sense because when Beverly Jenkins talked to the host of the Turn On Pod, she says that people were asking for that book for like years. So I guess it really could be more recent. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, okay. Well, so this was the question I was going to ask, and it kind of the linchpin of the question depended on Forbidden being slightly older. Oh, well. Okay, so you and I have been talking sort of offline a bit, well, online, but privately, about the idea of what the modern romance canon is or should be or can be. And you helped me work through some stuff, some questions I had, because, like, I started this project without an actual end goal in mind. And I was just like, oh, I'm just gonna like ask people and then like I'll figure it out along the way. And I think that one thing I will say I think is important to asking this question is I'm defining, and I haven't actually said this, but I'm defining the modern romance canon as exemplars of the genre that are relevant and important and not dated right now at this point in time. Which means, and this is kind of what I want to talk to you about, is stripping away the nostalgia of I started reading romance 20 plus years ago. A lot of romance readers started reading a while ago, and the books that were available at the time, if you reread them now, are can be quite problematic. And while they resonated with us or me at the time I read them 20 years ago, I'm a different person now. I live in a different world now. Thank goodness, I think the romance genre has evolved in a positive direction generally. I think the modern romance canon, books that are nominated for it, are books that speak to the individual creating the nomination at this point in time, and also acknowledge that there can be no absolute canon list. It is basically just a growing list of nominations of books that are subjectively important to somebody.
So one of our online but offline conversations, I sort of said, and I stand by this, that historians don't believe in a canon. Like historians absolutely believe in foundational text, but depending on what you're studying and when you're studying, those foundational texts can change, right? So when I was an undergrad, we had to read about sort of methodology, which a lot of undergrads get some exposure to. And sort of the kind of foundational text we read was E.H. Carr's What is History? It's actually a series of lectures that this British historian gave in like it's from like the 1960s or 70s or something like that, which is quite late if you consider it. But it's considered like a foundational text. And essentially what he's arguing is, as the title suggests, like what is history in terms of what is history scholarship, right? But in that same class, I read this book that I still cannot remember the name of, but it was about sort of the impact of Walt Disney on depicting American history through his films and theme parks and all of that stuff, right? And part of the reason that was a book that we read alongside Carr is because the historian who was teaching it was a historian of film. But if I had taken that class with, say, my advisor at that time, I would have read a different text because she was a more traditional historian in terms of her subject area, which is like deep archival work. But I probably would have read something on oral history because that is also hers. Because you can learn the foundational skills in almost any text, right? And so we don't believe in a canon because we understand there is a multiplicity of texts that can teach you the things you need to know about how history functions. So the idea of a canon is so foreign to me. It's almost, I mean, I feel like an outsider looking in with like a tub of popcorn. It's like, ooh, that's fascinating. Who cares? But so as you were talking, I did look up when another book, because I think one of the things that Beverly Jenkins does really well is she sort of comes back to themes. And the other book I would have suggested for the canon would have been Indigo. And Indigo was written in 1996. And I mentioned that only because that hero is not white passing, but he is light skinned. And she does a similar thing in that one where you see this hero who has more social privilege. He's also rich. Like there's this explicit point in that book where his family members who are light skinned, and he's also from a freeborn family, and the woman he's fallen in love with was formerly enslaved and has an enslaved mother, or actually both of her parents are enslaved. And so their objection to her is one, that she is dark skinned and that she has a history of bondage. And so you see him, he is able to protect his privilege, which Ryan is in Forbidden as well. But you see in that book, Beverly Jenkins making a sort of similar assertion that these privileges, which come with a proximity to whiteness, are not the things that matter to these heroes, right? And I think she's done that in other books, but that is the other point where I see her doing that. And so it's a little bit older. And so, but yeah, it is this sort of idea. Those things stick out to me because of who I am and what I study, but you're right that it's who I am and what I study.
Yeah. And you were saying, like, I was trying to think, like, why does it make sense to me to even ask the question of, like, what do you consider canon? And I wonder if part of it is, you know, my academic history. I studied writing, literature, and publishing as an undergrad, and, you know, certainly had the books that I read in high school. It was the canon of literature, and I reject that canon. Because I believe that it is very much rooted in a particular point of view that does not resonate with me. And I've talked about that before on the podcast. So it's like I definitely know that that canon is not my canon. And so then, you know, thinking about like the romance genre, I think that there are a lot of books that, you know, people who have been reading romance for a while kind of identify as like, oh, these are books that were like maybe like milestone type books or like really popular at the time and can speak to the zeitgeist of the moment.
Or that I'd imagine that there are those books that they read right as they were starting to understand their own sexuality or something. That,
Exactly, right. And I mean, like this is why people talk about The Flame and the Flower, not because necessarily it was the first to do something, but it was maybe like the first to be extremely popular for doing something, and it had such a widespread awareness, and you know, people have continued to read it over time that like it becomes a touch point that people can kind of speak to and have, there's like a common language around it. I mean, I feel like romance is so vast and so personal. And now I'm like sitting here, I'm like, I don't know, does that apply to like just literary novels as well? I don't know. I don't have the answers. But then layer on top of this, my master's degree is in marketing. My history of working in publishing is I worked at a literary magazine. So like, you know, I was working with, you know, people who get like big prizes for literature. That's who I was coming in contact with. Those people respected the canon, okay? The quote unquote literary canon. Then shifting over to dealing with content and publishing from a marketing side, where a lot of times my approach to thinking about content in that world is much more like, how do I make this manageable and bite-sized so that people can wrap their minds around it and communicate something? And so I think that then that's like my impulse to like, let me make a list.
I mean, I definitely, there's part of me that deeply, I feel very similar in the sense that, so I don't know if I've talked about this, but part of my training is in intellectual history, which is why I have too many thoughts about various things and also why I dissect what feels like the most minor detail into like, whatever paragraphs, because I fundamentally believe in that as an exercise, right? But part of that training also is actually sort of accidental because I'm a first generation college student, so obviously the first person in my family to get an MA or a PhD. And so part of how I coped with feeling out of my depth at every level is to read and acquire information about all of the books or articles that exist in that way. So I believe in a bibliography. Like, I am the person. I teach a class on Reconstruction. It's a graduate course. And last time I taught it, like half of the students transferred out when I sent the syllabus because it's a historiography class as well. And so this actual syllabus is like 15 pages long because under each topic with our readings, I then have further. It's not even suggested readings, it's just like further information on the topic, and it's all articles because we mostly read books. And each section has like 30 articles underneath it. And so students thought they would have to read all of those 30 articles as well as their like 200, 300 pages for the week. And I was like, well, it's not, it's not possible. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know that. So they like, they jump ship. And they were like, I'm not doing that. But that's because I deeply believe in that you need to understand that the book I chose for you to read on this topic is part of a larger historiography of, you know, 300 other texts probably that deal with this in part or in full that you would also have to consider to make a sound argument. So I believe in this project, if for no other reason that this is how I cope.
Thank you. And it's interesting when you said that because I'm actually the only person in my immediate family with a master's degree. Neither of my parents have a bachelor's degree. My sister has a bachelor's degree. But like higher ed is not something that like my family is comfortable with. Like
right.
Both of my parents grew up like very poor and I doubt both of their parents even graduated high school. Like,
right.
You know, so getting an advanced degree in anything and exploring work, like work in my family is very tangible.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I, as you were saying that, I was like, oh my God, is that also why like I have this, what feels like an unquenchable thirst for knowledge? Because I feel like I never know enough.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, I still feel to this day like I don't know enough because I don't know enough because there's still like new books being written. There are archives I've never been to, obviously. And I think earlier in my life, I processed that as a lack, which is why I, you know, sort of believed in the building of knowledge or the knowing, reading about and knowing about as many texts as I could. But I've tried in the past few years, especially now that I'm a professor and I'm supposed to be, quote unquote, the expert in the room. I, one, make sure I tell my students that on many of the things I teach them, I'm not the expert, right? I've read many of the things I'm recommending to them or I'm assigning to them. But I also process the, which I think is maybe what you're trying to do with the creation of this canon as a communal thing. I also sort of, at this point, I process the accumulation of knowledge about, you know, research, knowledge about historical texts as a means to make them accessible. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. When someone asks me, you know, for a book on a particular topic, I'm happy if I can, you know, if I know of a text, I'm happy to give it to them. But one of the things I enjoy doing is giving them a text that is written to be accessible to non-experts because historians like other scholars tend to write to other historians. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we use jargon. We use sort of heavy historiographical conversations to make what sometimes can feel like really sort of boring. like
you use the term diaspora.
Which is hilariously the most accessible term I could use.
It really is. It really like, and it means something. But like, I sat down to read "Reading the Romance" by Janice Radway, and I literally started writing words that I was like, in the front of the book, where I was like, oh shit, I don't know what this means, and then I looked up and I was like, oh okay, well that's obviously the right word to use there. Like it's very precise, but it doesn't really mean anything to me. Like just in
right.
conversation. Yeah. And like you were talking about the kind of for each topic on your syllabus, like, and then here's like some other books. I'm thinking about that. Like, I think so many times myself and other people, when you're like, I want to explore like this new topic, it can be extremely overwhelming to even know where to start.
Right.
Like, how do I start to learn about this thing? And like, what are some good sources? If you're doing that yourself, what you end up doing is you either get so overwhelmed that you shut down, or you end up on this quest where you have to almost discover for yourself what are good and bad sources, which, you know, is fine. But sometimes it's like, can somebody please just give me a curated list of like a place to start? And if I'm truly interested, I will continue to explore, but please make it bite-sized. And I think that that actually connects to maybe part of what was in my head with the canon was like, okay, these are books that are meaningful to this person at least. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe not going to be as resonant for you as it was for that person or some other people, but it's at the very least not a bad place to start.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that because you're exactly right. Part of what I try and do with that syllabus, I give them that list and I tell them that the first day, if anyone would have stayed, they would have gotten this part of the lecture. is that at the end of the semester, they have to write a historiographical essay on something relative to Reconstruction. That list of articles has at least 5 articles that will come up no matter what their topic. So when they are stressing out by the midterm or by mid-semester about what they will do for their final research project, I tell them, go through the list of articles I gave you and find 5 on the topic you want to study. And then you don't have to do that work on finding your first text, right? Like that is the whole goal. And I think when I stumbled into romance explicitly, I did a couple of things. So the first thing I did is I saw there was a lot of chatter about Alicia Rye's Serving Pleasure because it had made the New York Times bestsellers list, I think, something like that. And it was the first self-published romance to do that, it was the first in some way. And because it was everywhere, I was like, okay, I'll give it a try. And it was a fabulous book, right? So then I literally have tracked this in my Goodreads. From then on, I started reading almost entirely romance for like a solid year or something like that. But what I found in looking at what I read is I read a lot of stuff I didn't like. Because I was like, oh, I can read other self-published stuff, or I can read, you know, other things by, you know, these authors that Amazon is recommending as similar. And, you know, once you are looking for information or looking for books, but you don't know where to go, you are dependent on other people's recommendations, which are often flawed, or you're dependent on, you know, whatever database you're using on its flawed algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until a friend who, one, I know, two, who knows me, and we know each other's reading habits, recommended an Alyssa Cole novella. And then, so look, I definitely recommend people sort of go through their own reading histories to see how they have shifted and changed, because it's been really useful for me. So the point at which that friend recommended, actually it wasn't an Alyssa Cole novella, it was the first book in her Civil War series. It was An Extraordinary Union. Mm-hmm. From there, I started reading, one, everything Alyssa had written, but I also explicitly moved into Black historical romance, which I had said earlier in my career I would never want to read because I imagined it would be like trauma porn. Mm-hmm. So I moved directly from Alyssa to Beverly Jenkins. And once you can get, and that, I mean, that's sort of the thing you want, right? When you can find amongst the sea of texts the thing that works for you, based on the recommendation or who recommended it, you then can make a more targeted move into whatever the next thing is. And so instead of saying you have to read this romance novel from 1954, which was really significant at the time, being able to find a book that speaks to you as you are now and then moving. Because I've also, from Beverly Jenkins, moved to Tessa Dare, right? Mm-hmm. Like it isn't as if that is a circumscribed path, but you can figure out the things you do like and then make your way there. So I absolutely do believe that a conversation about the canon that feels very presentist can actually be really useful. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense to my own training.
Yeah. And I think there's like an element of like, nobody can read everything.
Right. Oh my God.
Oh my God. No. And there's no person that has had a broad enough experience with everything to be like, okay, well, I looked at everything.
Yeah.
And here are the best. I mean, even if you take apart the fact that there's bias in that, right?
Right.
But also, so much has happened. And I don't think that to appreciate romance now, you have to have had that survey.
Like,
right. I mean, I'm obviously interested in sort of like the evolution of the romance genre.
Right.
But you don't have to know all of that. I just found out that like gothic romances were kind of like a foundation for the romance genre. I'm like, oh my God, wow. Like, cool. I'm not going to go read a bunch of gothic romances because like, I kind of don't care.
But meanwhile, I love gothic romance, but I never jumped from gothic romance into like whatever romance looked like when I was a kid. It didn't make sense to me.
Right. So, I mean, so part of it is like, I am a longtime romance reader. You probably have enough experience at this point in romance reading to have, you do have like, you know, opinions and like books you could recommend and whatever. But like, if somebody tomorrow is like, I want to try romance and they don't have a good romance friend, it's super hard to like get in and really like figure out where to start that. I mean, you don't want people to pick up one random book. Like this calls to mind my conversations with my friend Becky, where she is randomly picking up a romance novel, basically. And then I'm like, have thoughts about this and talk to me and tell me all the things you think you're reading in this book mean all romance novels are like this. And then I'll tell you you're wrong.
Right. I'm a mood reader, so I have a friend, so that same friend who recommended Alyssa Cole's books, her name's Nicole. We literally, sometimes our DMs are just me sending her links to books to buy, and she just buys them. It's very useful. She's a great friend. But part of why, and she is not someone who reads explicitly, reads only romance, but we do tend to trade lots of kinds of books. But part of why she's so useful for me is even though she'll read almost anything I recommend to her, we then have a great conversation afterwards, whether or not she liked it. Mm-hmm. And I can't always tell what she will like. So I recommended the Kit Rocha Beyond books kind of on a whim because I didn't think that they were her thing. And then she was like, 2 weeks later, like, I spent all this money on these books. And I was like, okay. So anyway, now you can read the writer's book. She's lovely. But and she did. But she's really useful because both of our introductions were accidental. And then we kind of stumbled on the things we like together. And there's always a different mood for us too. I don't know how I got on this from what you were saying, but I definitely related it in my head. But I think that there's this way at which romance is also communal. So if you stumble onto whatever is on, you know, the bookshelves at your local bookstore, you almost miss the communal aspect of someone being able to say, well, what are you interested in like other genres? Or what are you interested in life? Like if you're interested in, like, I love mysteries and I love true crime, but interestingly enough, I never read anything that kind of correlates to that in romance. I have no idea why. I'd love to, but I don't know what I'm looking for yet. Or that's not true. I read one person, Nicole Rise, who writes really short murder mystery romance novellas. They're hilarious, but it's random, right? So you can't always say that idea of a canon, a book that everyone has to read, almost misses the fact that the whole point of reading is also supposed to be individual and or communal, right?
And also that the point of reading books isn't to, like, just read the ones you have to. And, like okay, well, right. I read all 5 books and now I'm done.
Right. I've read, and, like, how many, which I find so interesting because I remember, I tell the story to my students a lot. It's not at all relevant. But I remember hating high school English. I loved to read as a kid, but I hated high school English.
Same.
And junior high English, to be honest with you. But I remember I had this really old, stodgy teacher who clearly hated that he was still teaching because every generation of kids, he hated them a little bit more. He was so great. And he was the kind of person who pronounced harassment like he was British because he didn't want us to say ass. So he would say harassment. Harassment, which was hilarious. And I hated it and I loved him at the same time. So I remember dreading taking, this was 9th grade English. And I remember dreading taking it because the sort of the narrative we got about high school English is that you started reading the canon. Like junior high, they sort of kind of don't care. You read whatever. But in high school, there seems to be this idea that you have to start reading the great books. And I was so annoyed.
Like Heart of Darkness.
Right. And I was like, I was dreading it because I had up until that point been really privileged to have teachers who encouraged me to read whatever I liked. Right. We had reading for class, but in terms of like building a love of reading, they were like, well, read whatever sort of connects to you. And that could be literally anything. And so I was dreading that class. And then I remember early on, you know, he was sort of giving his little lectures about how we all need to read great literature and blah, 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 blah. And then we got the reading list. And there are 2 books that I read in that class that stuck with me still. And one was Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart. And the other was Dorothy Allison's Bastard Out of Carolina. And I remember thinking, well, this isn't the canon I'd been told I was going to read. And I realized that, and really all the books on his syllabus were because he wanted us to read books that spoke to the fact that most of his students were poor and a lot of his students were not white. And so we read books and short stories by Mexican-American authors. I'm from California, so a lot of my you know friends and classmates were Mexican-American. We read books by African and African-American authors. We read a whole bunch of female writers. And I realized in that moment that, I mean, I did have to confront classes where we read the canon and I hated it. But here was this old man who hated all of his students. Who was very specific that there is no singular canon. There doesn't have to be a singular canon. What matters here is that you create your own personal canon. And I still adore Dorothy Allison, partially because of him.
That's a sweet
story. Who was also the first lesbian author I ever read. So even just that he was like, we're going to read a book by a poor white lesbian woman writing about abuse. I mean, he gave all the trigger warnings and it was still the best book I ever read.
And now Eric Sellinger shares his take on this project. Dr. Eric Sellinger is the executive editor of the Journal of Popular Romance Studies, also known as JPRS, and is a founding member of the International Association for the Study of Popular Romance, which is referred to by the cool kids as YASPR. The romance canon part of it, I might be really bastardizing what canon means, because as I started thinking about it more, and this is what I was alluding to talking about with Katrina Jackson, was working through this idea, like, I don't think you can ever create a discrete list or even a sort of amorphous discrete list, like where people say, well, I would take that one out and put this one in. I just don't think that's possible for a lot of reasons. So I'm at a very weird place with this project where I'm really glad I started asking the question and I'm building this list of romances that individuals subjectively think are exemplars of the genre that would be really relevant to a reader today, which if you kind of think, what's the point of asking this question at all, is to give people a starting point of where to begin with a genre, maybe it functions as that and it just kind of keeps growing. But my understanding is that JPRS is working on asking this question currently for a forthcoming issue, maybe? I heard tell.
Rumors have reached you. So yeah, I'll tell you what's going on. So we got a submission co-authored by a scholar and a university librarian. That's kind of a proposal, a thought experiment about what is a romance canon and how could it be determined and what are the issues involved in a university library acquiring the volumes that could then be part of the collection, which a professor could then be assigning and students could be reading and so on and so forth, right? So it's
and
about...
And so that's like a very practical...
It's very specifically about the institutional side of canons, but as we all know, right, the institutional side of canons is how canons get...
Like integrated into curriculum?
Well, they get integrated into curriculum. I was going to say they get militarized, right? That they get, you know, there's the joke about what's the difference between a language and a dialect. And the answer is the language has the bigger army and navy, right? It's about power. And so the institutional power of a romance canon could have all kinds of ripple effects, right? Once some university or groups of universities have decided that such and such group of novels is in the romance canon, the next thing you know, the Library of America is calling up somebody and saying, how'd you like to edit the Library of America anthology of American popular romance, right? Because we have one on hard-boiled detective fiction and we have one, you know, horror and so on and so forth. And then that becomes the volume that everybody orders for their classes, and the canon becomes more and more restricted to the set of texts that are being taught in academia. So it's a fraught issue, both in terms of the decision making that goes into what is or is not canonical and into the what are the ramifications of having made those announcements. So we got this submission, and the submission was very specifically designed to be a conversation starter. So it's not, you know, here's my peer-reviewed essay about this, which is right or wrong, but rather, here's a proposal, what do people think? And so one of the things that we then did was approach, might have been about a dozen people by all told. I'm not sure how many will actually write their responses, but I solicited responses from scholars, I solicited responses from librarians, I solicited responses from romance reviewers and bloggers and authors and some people who wear multiple hats, mm-hmm. particularly with an eye to people who can speak to the race and gendered and sexuality impacted politics of canon formation. So in August, if you're listening and you haven't given me your pay, your response yet, please get it to me. Right. But in August, we'll be receiving the responses and we'll be editing, you know, a special forum of the journal that will have the original essay and then it will have the responses by various people. So I'm old enough to remember the canon wars of the 80s. That was when I was an undergraduate and graduate student starting my graduate studies. I'd do like, I remember, you know, the old days. I remember those debates. And I came up through that moment in academic history. And so to me, I'm always very, very hesitant when somebody wants to talk about the romance canon. I tend to think that canons happen. I tend to think that they happen through a mix of sort of organic processes and institutional processes, and that the institutional ones, at least, can be really problematic. And I tend to think that they don't need any encouragement.
Yeah.
That they'll, you know, that there is something good and freeing about the fact that there is no established academic canon. There's no authority that is, you know, trying to say the certain things. Well, I shouldn't say there's none, because there are hints of it, right? You know, a lot of us, when we teach surveys of the romance genre, a lot of us start with E.M. Hall's The Sheik, which ought to be The Shake, but they pronounced it The Sheik back in the 20s. And that's because a couple of pieces of scholarship talk about that, use that as a starting point. And so academics start where somebody else has started. Oh, that's been, now we know that's where it begins, so I'll start there. It's not at all an inevitable place to start. If you start with that, you end up going in certain directions that you wouldn't be going in if you started with Barclay's The Rosary, or, you know, another work of sort of what we would now call Christian inspirational romance, or start even a little bit older in the early 1900s. I mean, there are lots of places you could start.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the practical reasoning that mm-hmm. drives academics to want to have a canon. And I understand the practical reasoning and the affective reasoning that makes people outside academia want to have a canon, because you want to have, as you say, something that you can point to for new readers, and something that you can point to, you know, with pride, and something you can point to and say, this is really good. And there's the possibility then of a kind of shared conversation, which is fun. And we like to be able to talk about certain books. But, you know, after 15 years, which is not a long time, you know, critical history, but there were books 15 years ago that everybody assumed were sort of canonical. And as you say, that hold up as well, or that seem very problematic, or just they haven't aged well. There are authors that used to be, you know, frequent reference points in romance conferences. Everybody was talking about this author, everybody's talking about that author, and they've now drifted to the periphery of the conversation. I don't know that we need to stop that flow from happening. And mm-hmm. I think what you are trying to do is something that's much less, because it's on a podcast and because you're grounding it in individual opinions, you know, you're calling it a romance canon, but it's not going to function the way that canons, when we really talk about a canon, we're talking really about an activity in certain circles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've looked through the list. I look, you know, there are books that are on there. I'm like, yes, there are books that are on there. I say, ooh, I haven't read that. That sounds good. Somebody really likes that. And mm-hmm. I like other things that they've liked. But that's different from two things. It's different from you really can't understand contemporary popular romance unless you've read
mm-hmm.
Move, right? How can you talk about contemporary fantasy if you don't know the Silmarillion? Right. You know, that's mm-hmm. there's a particular kind of move that, you know, throwing down my authority as, you know, because I've read
gatekeeping,
this, right? Gatekeeping, ensuring that the authors that were important to me when I was a young man, and it's often men that do this, you know, remain centrally important. Mm-hmm. H.P. Lovecraft, Robert Heinlein, you know, Isaac Asimov, right? In science fiction. This is a big discussion, I think, that's been going on. And then there's also the move of people sort of who like to argue about, you know, as you say, like what should be on that list. Mm-hmm. It always makes me think of, remember the movie, I guess it was a novel first, but the movie is what I know, High Fidelity, mm-hmm. with John Cusack and Jack Black and other folks. And the Jack Black character, they're working in the record store, and the Jack Black character is always confronting John Cusack or somebody else coming into the record store and saying something like, top five double albums from the 1970s, best opening song, side three, reverse order, go.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody will start, you know, saying the name of a song, and he'll be like, wrong.
Right, you know, right.
So it's like, that's kind of a canon discussion, but I don't know. That's not the game that I like. That's not the game I like to play.
It's funny because it's not the game I like to play either, But let's remember that basically my professional history is working in like commercial publishing and content marketing. And I think that this is where I'm realizing it seems obvious to me that if I want to do a project, I need to like brand it somehow in a way that's like interesting. Mm-hmm. So I fully acknowledge that I'm actually, upon a lot more reflection, not actually trying to create a canon, because a lot of the points that you've made, there is this association with canon with like foundational texts, mm-hmm. right? Like, in order to understand everything that comes after this, you have to have like read this one, because right. it's like, you know, the touch point that then mm-hmm. everything is
sure.
reflecting on. Yeah, so I'm not actually interested in doing that. So you know, this is me just being like, I totally see, like, I'm looking back on it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's okay. Not actually what I was trying to do, but I used a word that means something.
It's not like, I don't think you're doing any harm. You know, it's not like somebody is going to, I mean, I suppose it's possible. If I think back to myself in 2005, just getting started, you know, like, oh my gosh, I get to teach my first popular romance class. What should I teach? I wonder if anybody has a romance canon, and I could like Google it and then I'd pull up your list. But honestly, like, what's the harm?
This is however
many novels that somebody has recommended, and it's, I'm sure, a good place to begin.
It was search engine optimization, really. That's what was happening. I do think it's very important, though, this question of whose voice matters in this question and who the curator of this list is. And I will say one of the things that was very intentional about my project was that you will never see me contribute. Well, I won't say never. The list, if at any point I contribute anything to the canon, it will be a very small percentage. It's not my list of what Andrea Martucci thinks is canon. Mm-hmm. I did think it was very important that it be a variety of voices from, hopefully, as much as I am able to sort of have on my show people of a wide range of viewpoints and, you know, coming from sort of like different pockets of the genre with different perspectives and therefore different ideas about what's important and meaningful to them. But even with those like good intentions, I recognize that there are limitations there in representing everybody. I do not think that there is possibly a list that you are guaranteed somebody will find at least one book that really resonates with them to the point where it could be one of their favorite books. Like, is that possible? I don't know if it is, just because, as I think you've written about and, you know, we're speaking to, like, it's so huge. The mm-hmm. variation within the genre is almost incomprehensible. Particularly now with, you know, self-pub, where the gatekeepers mm-hmm. of, you know, traditional publishing aren't even creating some boundaries around that anymore.
Right. Like I said, it's not a bad question. Nothing bad's going to come of it. But as I say, I think, and this isn't my idea, I try to give credit to people. You know, this was, must have been, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe more. There was a piece by Noah Berlatsky about romance and canon that got a lot of flack. A lot of people were annoyed by it and were offended by it, because they took him to be saying, when he said that there was no canon in romance, they took him to be saying there were no really good iconic books. And what he was saying was, there's nothing that functions as a list that has the imprimatur of people who consider themselves to be authorized to declare this book is canon, this book is not. You know, there's no Harold Bloom announcing the romance canon. There's no body that seems to be declaring that. And arguments about what should be on that list don't seem to preoccupy people. And a lot of the authors and bloggers and scholars who responded to his article, and, you know, mostly were critiquing the article for various reasons, but a lot of them ended up saying something sort of similar. I think Jody McAllister down in Australia said, well, you know, there's not a canon, but there are iconic works. Mm-hmm. There are reference point works, right? There are touchstone novels, she might have said. There were a bunch of other sort of terms that were thrown around. Mm-hmm. Lynn Burrow, the publisher of Bold Strokes Books, who publishes lesbian romances, Radcliffe. I remember at a panel about popular romance at the Library of Congress that I was on with her She said, well, there's an academic canon, there's a reader's canon, and there's an author's canon. And then each of those would break down somewhat because there are sort of different academic canons and there are different reader canons depending on who the readers are. And there are different author canons depending on who the authors are that you're talking about. I remember joking when that mic came to me that canons aren't like, it's not like Highlander, right? You know, it's not that there has to be just one. There can only be one.
Right.
There are going to be lots of them. So having yours out there is like, here's one.
There's one. Yep.
Here's how it was produced, you know, kind of crowdsourced by these authors. And they're an interesting and diverse bunch of people. And the books that they're recommending are interesting and diverse. And frankly, I'd much rather have a canon out there like that than for me as the editor of Jeepers to have like something on the Jeepers page or something on the Asper web page that says the International Association for the Study of Popular Romance
has determined.
Says, here is the canon.
Right.
I have a beard, so listen to me.
Exactly. Right, right.
No, you know, nobody needs that. Nobody needs that. And even if they want that, they don't need that.
As someone who is highly self-critical, I think a lot of this like sort of transparent discussion of like, what the heck was I doing? Is a little bit of that child wandering into the room of a war that has been going on. A conversation that has been going on and me just like sitting down one day and being like, I don't know, this sounds good. And then here we are. But then there's going to be a podcast episode where everybody can see my thought process. So.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I'm very curious to hear what people have to say. I wouldn't have agreed to do this special forum at Jeepers if I didn't think this was a conversation worth having. Because there is, there are practical exigencies involved as librarians. You know, anybody who's a librarian, especially at the university, will tell you, you know, the issue of which are the books that we're going to have in the collection and thereby continue to make available as books, you know, especially if they're ebooks. They appear, they disappear, mm-hmm. The publisher might go under, you know, there are books that I love to teach. I remember when Riptide imploded and a lot of authors pulled their work from Riptide or were given the opportunity to take back their copyright. There were some books that I loved to teach in my classes that I couldn't assign for a while because Riptide was no longer publishing them. These are real hurdles in the way of scholars who want to do certain kinds of research on the romance genre. So it's, you know, it's a serious question. It's a worthwhile topic.
Thanks for listening to episode 52. And thank you to Katrina and Eric for sharing their expertise today. Eric will be back in a forthcoming episode in which we discuss Glitterland by Alexis Hall. And you know Katrina will be back, but you can also check out any of her previous 7 episodes. That number is not a joke. Check the show notes for links, plus all of the details for this episode can be found on shelflovepodcast.com, including a transcript for this episode. Look for episode 52. I have also collected the full list of modern romance canon nominations on a page on my website. Thank you for joining me today. If you have any thoughts on the show, I would love for you to reach out to me. You can send an email to andrea@shelflovepodcast.com. Black Lives Matter. Stay safe, stay mad, and keep reading romance.